I say it's time we put Al Capone and his bums out of business. For good!
George Bugs Moran.
You can start a war with Capone, but you're not going to win it.
This is the Runners Up Club, a podcast about unsung heroes, lovable losers, and forgotten failures. For those with a few minutes to spend on those who spent theirs in a losing cause.
It's 1924. Prohibition is in full swing, and so is the era of the Chicago bootlegger. George Bugs Moran stares across the coffin of Dean O'Banion, murdered leader of the North Side Gang, at Johnny Torrio and his lieutenant, Al Capone, coldly contemplating vengeance. It was no secret that the Italians had arranged the hit on O'Banion. The murder would spark 5 years of bloody gang warfare between the North Side Irishmen and the Italians in the so-called Chicago Outfit in the South, culminating in a famous shooting on February 14, 1929. Moran did not die that Valentine's Day, but he was effectively finished as a real rival to Capone. Hi folks, Ray A. here. Welcome to the show. Today we consider the man who fought Al Capone bullet for bullet and block by block for control of the Chicago crime racket, a man with just the sort of crazy charisma that might have made his a more enduring and even, dare I say it, endearing face in the murderer's row of gangland leaders. We'll start in 1912 or so. George Moran was 19 and still going by his birth name, Adelard Coonan, when he ran away from his home in St. Paul, Minnesota, and found a place among the street toughs of Chicago. Within a couple of years, he could boast arrests for burglary, larceny, and horse snatching. That's where you steal a horse and demand ransom from the owner. He had 3 stints in the Huskow and a 4-inch knife scar on his neck, earned while confronting a heckler at an outdoor speech.
Well, I don't have to tell you how they ended up.
By most accounts, Moran was more street smart than smart smart. His tempers ran hot, impetuous flashes of rage earning him the nickname Bugs, which implied crazy. But beneath it all, as we'll see a little later, was an impish humor and an underdog's spunky charm. By 1923, after running with other colorfully nicknamed Northsiders like Charles the Ox Riser, Hot Stove Jimmy Quinn, Tommy the Terrible Tui, Moran was a full-on member of the Northside Gang. Under O'Banion's leadership, the crew had their hands in burglary, gambling, and graft. Since passage of the Volstead Prohibition Act in 1920, of course, the big money was where the mouths were. The city's bootlegging gangs were allied in fragile confederation at this time. The territories were generally agreed upon, but the gangs were always angling for advantage, and a casual insult or a clever double cross would be enough to bring out the switchblades and the Tommy guns. Turns out that's exactly how Dean O'Banion got in bad with the Italians. He arranged to have his erstwhile partner Johnny Torrio caught in a brewery raid hours after selling out his own interest in the place. Incredibly ballsy on O'Banion's part, no doubt, but not so sound from a capo strategic perspective. After compounding the dig at Torrio with further slights against other Italian gangs in the city, O'Banion was gunned down in his flower shop inside the year. This puts Bugs Moran at his mentor O'Banion's funeral, where we started this episode. O'Banion's death leaves Moran among the new leaders of the North Side Gang with 2 other guys, Jaime Weiss and Vincent Drucci. The 3 of them are up against Torrio and Capone. North Side versus South Side, Irish versus Italians.
Or maybe when a friend of yours is gone, you don't give a damn no more. Well, I do. And Dini O'Banion was my friend, and I don't forget him. And I don't forget who had him knocked off.
The Italians had roots in New York City, and for that reason, amongst others, tended to have more men, more guns, and the bigger footprint in the Chicago turf wars, which included several other gangs as well. Now, the next 5 years play out like a string of cinematic cliches, but with real guns. During one attempt on Torrio's life, Moran has a gun to the Italian's head after a shootout ambush outside his apartment. Click, no more bullets. Sirens sound, Moran and his men flee. This seriously happened. In another even more auspicious moment, Moran led a fleet of cars in front of Capone's hotel headquarters, demolishing the lobby with thousands of rounds of submachine gun fire. Much glass was shattered, a young boy almost lost an eye, Capone was unhurt. Within a few months, Weiss and Drucci are dead, and Moran sits alone atop the North Side Gang. For regular listeners of the podcast, you'll know that we try to flag those moments in a runners-up life when a different result may have yielded a vastly different outcome. Consider Moran's failed attempt on Capone's life at the Hawthorne Inn in Cicero, Illinois, just such a moment. The alternate history where Capone dies that day probably does not include the decimation of the Northside Gang less than 3 years later, and may just replace Capone's face on the Biggest Gangster Ever poster with that of Moran's. Well, we'll never know. Capone didn't die in Cicero, but he was pretty spooked. Capone and the Northsiders agree to a truce. Good-natured backstabbing and the occasional arson attack appear to be inbounds, but fusillade of bullet-style assassination attempts were not. The detente held for a while. I mean, stuff would happen, sure, the way it does in gangland. Bugs would hijack Capone's booze shipments. Al would burn down one of Bugs's dog tracks. Bugs would burn down one of Al's clubs. Bugs would have one of Al's personal friends or gang members killed. Then another one. Then another one. In retrospect, Bugs was actually piling it on a bit heavy during this period, Capo strategically speaking, and his habit of calling Capone at the Lexington Hotel and blowing raspberries through the receiver was certainly not making matters any more amicable. Well, now's a good time to pause to talk about Bug Moran's character, because he surely was a character. He had the requisite brutal heart, for sure. Blowing stuff up and killing people seemed to be second nature. He had the look, the three-piece suit and snap-brim fedora and pearl gray spats. But if Moran was a gangster from Central Casting, in many ways, it may have seemed the director was casting a screwball comedy. He was quick with an Irish joke or a put-down, usually aimed at Capone, who he called the Beast, the Behemoth, and a lowlife. When his enemies suggested it was time to capitulate, Moran's response was, "Nuts to you all!" There's a funny tale of Moran and his thug friends in their early days bungling a bank job and cracking up in mirth as they peeled away without the goods. In these moments, Moran seems less like Vito Corleone than Bart Simpson with a Tommy gun. The reporters on the gangland beat lapped this stuff up. In an interview around this time, before the massacre, Moran said, "The Beast uses his muscle men to peddle rotgut alcohol and green beer. I'm a legitimate salesman of good beer and pure whiskey. He trusts nobody and suspects everybody. He always has guards. I travel around with a couple of pals. The Behemoth can't sleep nights. If he asks me, he's on the dope. Me, I don't even need an aspirin." For all those not caught in the crossfire, which was most Chicagoans, all this gangland trash talk could be terribly entertaining. It definitely was not to Capone. By 1929, he'd had enough. Working with machine gun Jack McGurn, he put in motion the hit on Moran that would become known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Now, the plan was to stage a fake raid on Moran's crew in the Northside Gang's garage headquarters in Lincoln Park. Moran thought he was going to meet a local hijacker offering a great price on a stolen shipment of whiskey. He arrived late, however, and when he saw a police car parked out front, he turned back. A biography of Moran by Rose Keefe, the best I saw out there, is called The Man Who Got Away. His guys did not. McGurn's hired killers, all out-of-towners, two dressed as cops, had seven Northsiders up against the garage wall. They'd gotten the go-ahead to proceed when a lookout mistakenly thought Moran was amongst the group. Rounds from two Tommy guns, a sawed-off shotgun, and a .45 were emptied into the seven men's bodies, heads and torsos first. The gunmen walked out, fake cops leading fake perps in a show for any witnesses peering out between drawn blinds. Well, where'd it go from there? No one was ever tried or convicted of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre murders. Capone was in Miami at the time, but everyone knew he was behind it. Photos of the bloody victims outraged the public. The sensational crime made Capone a national celebrity in a bad way, putting him squarely in the sights of federal authorities. Bugs Moran soldiered on, holding his turf with what remained of his gang for a few years. Defections, bad alliances, and the repeal of the Volstead Act all took their toll, however. He eventually left Chicago, reverting to common crimes like robbery and counterfeiting while drifting state to state. He was caught by the FBI during a bank heist in Dayton, Ohio in 46, and but for a brief release 10 years later, spent the rest of his life in stir. He died of lung cancer in 57 at age 65 in Leavenworth Federal Pen, 10 years after Capone's death of cardiac arrest brought on from syphilis, stroke, and pneumonia. So, looking back, what's the measure of this man, Moran? Judge John Lyle reflected on his time on the bench in gangland Chicago in his book, The Dry and Lawless Years, in 1961. This is what he wrote.
As a man, Moran had interested me. In the many times he had been before me in court, I had discerned contradictions in his makeup. He was guilty of many wicked acts, but also he was sharp-witted, had a keen sense of humor, and at times was highly emotional. I had long thought that of all the gangsters I had observed, Moran was the most likely to repent.
60 years ago, Bugs was seen by some anyway as sort of the best of the worst. From our vantage, 70 years since his death, Moran's aptitude and leadership is the subject of plenty of debate. Some say that he was a thuggish reactionary who was continually outmaneuvered by Capone, and others that he was always the underdog in a battle stacked heavily against him, where simple survival was ample evidence of his wiles and grit. The Moran boosters point to the daunting differential in manpower and gunpowder between the North Side and Capone's outfit. The Moran haters rely primarily on the myth of Capone. That myth has, of course, been burnished in the public imagination the years since his death, well before Tony Soprano came along to make it okay to ambivalently root for gangsters. We'd already learned to look past Capone's brutality, committed mainly against other brutes and growing out of a foolhardy public policy, into the deeper reaches of his character. Moran has never been granted the courtesy of our fascination in quite the same way. Well, I hope I've been able to rebalance those scales just a bit. In cultural matters, those scales are, of course, widely tilted. On screen, Capone has been played by Rod Steiger, Jason Robards, Ben Gazzara, Robert De Niro, F. Murray Abraham, and other actors whose names you've heard of. Bugs Moran has been played by Dennis Patrick, Mervyn Vai, Ralph Meeker, and other actors whose names you have not. Actually, Harry Morgan is also on that list. That's Joe Friday's partner Bill Gannon to some of you, Colonel Potter to others, but the point remains. In 1930, Capone was named the first public enemy number one by the Chicago Crime Commission. George Bugs Moran was number six on the list. Here's maybe the biggest tell of all as we reckon Moran's standing in our memories. In a hypothetical scientific study where people are asked to name a gangster called Bugs, 79% of you will say Bugsy Siegel, 18% will say Bugsy Malone, who was not a real gangster but the fictional lead of a gangster musical, and 1.7% of the population, which is a very low but still distressingly non-zero percentage, will, with a completely straight face, say Bugs Bunny. You know who you are. But who am I? Oh, I'm Ray Agostinelli, and I've just noticed there's a convoy of thugs about to shoot out my windows. My getaway car is idling in the back alley. I gotta go. See you next time on The Runners Up Club.
This podcast is created, written, and performed by Ray Agostinelli and produced by, with original music by, Bad Hat Media. Find more at runnersupclub.com. Until next time, keep running.
That's the way Capone operates. That's the murdering double-crosser who swore up and down he'd keep the hell out of the North Side. Well, I'm not waiting around for Capone to put me in no cemetery.